Hello, welcome to Bare Naked Politics, the best podcast in the world, in my humble view, for understanding the headlines. So if you haven't watched the news in weeks, it doesn't matter. You will come away from each episode feeling informed on the topic at hand. And to be honest, I understand if you've been taking breaks from the news, especially recently, if you've been doing it more regularly than usual, because Jesus Christ, there's only so much bleakness that any of us can take. I'm at my wit's end of it, and I'm meant to be excited by the news, to be honest. I'm Julia Bell, and today we're running you through this impeachment trial where former President Donald J. Trump was judged by the Senate as to whether he was guilty of inciting insurrection. That's the term. So that was his charge, inciting insurrection, which is a very American-y, politics-y term, but essentially he was charged with encouraging a mob to rebel violently against the government. So the whole thing looked at the events of the Capitol Hill riot on the 6th of January. And you probably know the results by now that Trump swerved a conviction. So that makes two impeachments out of two that he's been acquitted.
The yeas are 57. The nays are 43. The Senate judges that the respondent, Donald John Trump, former President of the United States, is not guilty as charged in the article of impeachment.
So that was Patrick Leahy. I hope I'm saying his name right. Leahy. Leahy's voice on Saturday, the 13th of February. He is the person who presided over the trial. So he kind of acted like the speaker. You know, when you watch debates in the House of Commons and someone's shouting, order, order. He kind of acted like that. And you heard him there, or maybe you didn't, because he was actually quite mumbly. But he said that the votes came in at 57 to convict Donald Trump and 43 to acquit. So Trump walks away. Now you might be thinking, hang on, the bigger number is convict and the smaller number is acquit. So how come Trump gets to walk away? You needed 67. So 67 out of those 100 senators needed to vote to convict Trump or else it doesn't happen. So it's a two-thirds majority that's required rather than just a simple majority, which is where you get more than half. So yeah, 57 to convict, 43 to acquit. That was the final result on that impeachment trial. And remember, the Senate is split exactly down the middle at the moment. You've got 50 Democrats in there and 50 Republicans. And since obviously, all the Democrats voted to convict Trump, no surprise there. That actually means that seven Republicans broke ranks with their party and voted to convict Trump as well. That is a big deal. In Trump's last impeachment trial, only one Republican broke ranks and voted to convict him. I talked about him last time, Mitt Romney, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. A known enemy of Trump, the mutual disdain goes either way. But he already broke ranks last time. He did it again, but six other Republicans joined him this time. And that was quite a big deal. I would not like to be in their shoes because Trump's fan base are particularly passionate. They will be getting a lot of flack for turning against Trump there. But individually, they obviously all thought that was the best course of action. Doesn't matter what my party's doing. I don't think he deserves to be, you know, or I don't think he deserves to walk away from this scot-free. So it was quite a significant moment on that front. So yeah, in this episode, I just want to describe in a bit more detail what happened in the trial. It was only a four-day thing, so it was quick, but it was packed and it spanned through a range of emotions as you're watching it. Kind of at some moments, it was really gut-wrenching and emotional, particularly when talking about the events around the riot. And then it was really shocking. And then it got really weird at certain times. So I'll talk you through those three emotions. And later on in the episode, I did have the privilege of getting some reactions from Trevor McCriskin, who is an associate professor of US foreign policy, US politics, and American popular culture at Warwick University, which is where I went. So he was my lecturer back in the day. You'll know by now that American politics is my favourite subject, mostly because of him. So who better to have on to talk through this stuff with? So he will feature later on, like I say. So let's get on with it. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast or click follow, depending on what platform you're using. If you're listening on Spotify, please do click follow. It's right by the logo. It's free for you. It means you never miss an episode and it does me a world of good. So do that. And yes, trial, impeachment, Trump, Let's talk about it. Okay, so a bit of context. Of course, this impeachment trial was a direct result of the Capitol Hill riots on the 6th of January, 2021. If it wasn't for that event, this impeachment trial would not have happened. And I know for a fact that you will have seen pictures and videos of at least some of the stuff that happened on that day. And if you have, then you'll know that it was a violent event. People died, people were seriously injured, but on top of the violence, just the symbolism of it was abhorrent on so many levels. You know, you've got a mob of people that decide they don't like the election outcome, so they're going to break into the Capitol building, which is the equivalent of our Houses of Parliament, and they're going to damage the property, steal stuff from the inside, threaten the staff, physically hurt the people that are meant to protect it. It was just a disgusting thing. And the Democrats, pretty much immediately after it happened, placed heavy blame on the president at the time, Donald Trump. So members of the House of Representatives, which is like our House of Commons, so imagine a bunch of MPs, they signed an article to impeach Trump. And that was on the basis that they said, you're the reason this happened. You encouraged that mob to do that. And they pointed to a lot of things that Trump had done and said into the lead up, you know, to that event. Because, you know, after the election result in November, Trump constantly talked about how that election had been stolen and how it was rigged and how the Democrats cheated. But the big thing that they point to was this rally that Trump hosted. It was called the Save America Rally. And it only happened down the road from the Capitol building. And it was on the day of the riot. So the accusation is, here is proof that you incited insurrection, that you encouraged that mob, because you stood on stage and you told a bunch of people to, quote, stop the steal and to fight for their country. And then moments later, the members of that very crowd broke into the Capitol building shouting your words, stop the steal, fight for Trump. So it's a very, very long story cut short, but that's kind of how we got here. But just having the House of Representatives vote to impeach Trump, that's step one, right? That happened ages ago. That's been done. And that bit was easy because the House of Representatives is dominated by Democrats. It's a Democrat majority. So they could very easily get the majority they needed to sign that article for impeachment and to get this process underway. But step two is the trial in the Senate. And that's the trickier bit that we've just seen happen. That's the, you know, much more heavy duty. It's like a trial where the Senate gets to look at the evidence on either side and they then have a vote to convict or to acquit. And I said it before, this was Trump's second rodeo. So he's been through this before, but this time it did feel a bit riskier, I thought. There were times, last time I thought there's absolutely no way. This time I thought, oh, this is testy, just at times. And the way that this particular impeachment trial was laid out was you had a team of 9 impeachment managers, is their name, impeachment managers. And they're the team of people from the House of Representatives, and they were all Democrats, and they put together essentially a prosecution case against Donald Trump. So they're on one side and they're presenting to the Senate, trying to convince them that they should convict Trump. And then on Trump's team, he actually had a team of lawyers. So they weren't politicians as much as they were lawyers defending Trump. And they were presenting to the Senate saying, no, please acquit ex-President Trump. And Trump kind of behaves a bit like a criminal would in a trial. In fact, he didn't even have to go. So he didn't actually go. But it's as if, you know, everyone's talking about him and he's just sort of sitting, hoping for the best, much like usually criminals do in these instances. It is actually very weird to think that Trump didn't go. Like I say, he didn't have to. He could have voluntarily gone and he could have voluntarily testified, but he didn't. I don't know whether that was his decision or whether his team told him to, but it must have been weird for him to have this historical political event that the whole world is watching. It's all about you, and you're sitting in somewhere in Florida on what I can only hope was an inflatable flamingo in his pool. It's so weird. And actually, the prosecution team, or the, sorry, we should say the impeachment managers, this team of Democrats, desperately wanted Trump to go, but he didn't. And I can only assume it's because his team said, don't go. Shackle him to the inflatable flamingo, because the guy's a loose cannon. We don't know what he'll say. If we get him on that podium, he might do us in, and he might, you know, shoot us in the foot and get us in more trouble. You know, the guy got us in this mess in the first place. Let's just leave him in Florida. So I think that was probably the reason behind him not actually being at the event. So what were the arguments either side? It's actually pretty straightforward. So the impeachment managers, these nine Democrat members of the House of Representatives who were there to try to get Trump convicted, they were saying there is a direct connection between Trump's words and what happened on the 6th of January. So his words had a physical and ultimately violent impact. And to be honest, the nine Democrat impeachment managers did a really slick job. Like, it had been very neatly organized, and they had looked at reams and reams of evidence and video and audio and security camera footage. Like, it was a well-oiled machine, what they'd put together. And a lot of the videos that they were talking about had never been seen or released before. So, like I say, a lot of the security footage from the Capitol building, which was much, in my opinion, much scarier to watch than just the quick videos that you've seen from people's phones, because you can see, you know, someone running down a corridor and hiding in a room, and then a mob, a matter of seconds later, running down that same corridor. And you realise how lucky so many people were to survive, frankly, or to avoid getting hurt. And the kind of amazing thing about the Democrats' presentation was that they used that security footage to their advantage, and they told these stories in real time about what was happening with the mob and where they were in relation to the politicians that the mob were hunting down. So they showed this kind of cat and mouse type storyline of, you know, Nancy Pelosi's team running into a room and then a mob coming a matter of minutes later and trying to break down that door, and explaining how, you know, her team were just behind that door. They even had like maps and models of the Capitol building. So they showed these kind of dots, like on Google Maps, they showed these dots, different colours representing different people moving around the map of the Capitol building. It was honestly so compelling. In fact, let me just play you an example so you get an idea. Here is a clip of Stacey Plaskett. She's one of the impeachment managers, so she's one of these nine Democrats. And she was presenting a portion about Mike Pence, at the time, the vice president, who at the time we know was a massive public enemy number one of Trump's supporters, because he had gone against Trump and said, no, I'm going to recognize Biden's victory. So this day was the day that he did that. And this is why he was public enemy number one. So, you know, people were outside shouting, hang Mike Pence and find Mike Pence the traitor. But this clip is Stacey Plaskett talking about Mike Pence narrowly avoiding coming into contact with the mob who had at this time breached the Capitol building.
While all of this was going on, Vice President Pence was still in the room near the Senate chamber. It was not until 2:26 that he was evacuated to a secure location. This next security video shows that evacuation. His movements are depicted by the orange dot in our model. The red and blue dots represents the location where the mob and Officer Goodman were, and where Officer Goodman led the mob away from the chamber just moments ago. As Pence was being evacuated, rioters started to spread throughout the Capitol. Those inside helped other rioters break in through doors in several locations around this entire building. And the mob was looking for Vice President Pence because of his patriotism, because the vice president had refused to do what the president demanded and overturn the election results.
So that was Stacey Plaskett, one of these impeachment managers, giving a presentation. And you can hear how organized and how specific it was, and how she had models and dots and timings, precise timings of this cat and mouse vibe of Mike Pence walking through this door and then the mob coming past a few minutes later. Like, you had a real time understanding of how these events unfolded. And, you know, she wasn't just telling the story for the sake of it. She was constantly reminding the senators that she was presenting to, this all happened because of Trump. We are here because of Trump. These events are his fault. That was her angle. And actually, I don't know what it was about Stacey Plaskett's presentation, but there was another bit that really stuck with me, just because it was kind of haunting. In fact, I'll just play it for you. Although before I do, a brief trigger warning, because there's something really unsettling about it. It opens with a clip of a member of the mob who's hunting for Nancy Pelosi, who's the Democrat Speaker of the House. And any loyal Trump supporter hates Nancy Pelosi because they are just kind of on opposite sides of the spectrum. But you hear this mob member calling her name and essentially taunting her and searching for her within the walls of the Capitol building. And the way that Stacey Plaskett describes the timings of it is just incredibly close for comfort, how close this mob member gets to Nancy Pelosi's staff. I don't know, I've actually got shivers going down my spine thinking about it. There's something very unsettling about it. Here it is.
Nancy! Oh, Nancy! Nancy! Where are you, Nancy?
About the same time, Capitol Police announced that Capitol had been breached, Speaker Pelosi's staff heeded the call to shelter in place. On our model, you can see the riders in the rotunda in red and the Speaker's office again in orange. As you can see here, the staff moves from their offices through the halls and then enters a door on the right-hand side. That's the outer door of a conference room, which also has an inner door that they barricaded with furniture. The staff then hid under a conference room table in that inner room. After just 7 minutes of them barricading themselves and the last staffer entering the door on the right, a group of riders entered the hallway outside. And once inside, the riders have free rein in the Speaker of the House's offices. Pay attention to the door that we saw those staffers leading into and going into. One of the riders you can see is throwing his body against the door three times until he breaks open that outer door. Luckily, when faced with the inner door, he moves on. Another rider later tried, unsuccessfully, to break through that inner door.
So that was that. You're kind of hopefully piecing together what this presentation was like. And the more you listen to it, the more you realize how lucky those staffers were. That they weren't literally minutes later barricading themselves away, or they would have gotten caught. And the way that in those videos you can see these rioters behaving, it would have been deadly, 100%. And actually, when you see these videos, you see that the barricades that the staff members were using are just chairs and tables and whatever they could find shoved up against doors. It's like a desperate effort to keep themselves safe. It's not well organized. It's not like a practiced operation. There's not equipment available for them in the event of a Capitol riot. You can tell that this has not been practiced, and there's a real sense within these staffers that, oh my God, if I get caught, I'm going to die. Anyway, that gives you an idea of the prosecution against Trump, if you like. There was loads to it, but I think that's enough for us to be able to move on. Let's get to the arguments on the defense side. So there were two main ones. The first being, look, Trump isn't even in office anymore. Impeachments and convictions are all about stripping a president of his power and removing him from office. So why are we bothering with this when Trump doesn't have a position to be removed from? So that's kind of the first argument. We can debunk that in a second. But the second argument, and frankly, it's probably the argument that holds a bit more weight to it, is Trump is not directly responsible for this. Yes, he used fighting words. You know, he used words like, let's fight, fight like hell.
And they're not taking this White House. We're going to fight like hell, I'll tell you right now.
Don't take this sitting down.
We will never give up. We will never concede. It doesn't happen. We will not take it anymore. And that's what this is all about.
Stop the steal.
Stop the steal.
But these are metaphors, you know, and they're very commonly used by politicians across the spectrum. In fact, not just politicians, actors, lawyers, people, public speaking. This is a normal thing to do, is to talk fighting talk when you talk about politics. And on this point, Trump's defense team played a montage of videos of Democrats and Democrat supporting celebrities, including like Johnny Depp was one, and Madonna. They made appearances. He showed a montage of Democrats using this kind of language, exactly the same kind of language that Trump used at his rally. It's a long montage, but here's some of it.
Donald Trump, I think you need to go back and punch him in the face.
That I thought he should have punched him in the face.
Feel like punching him.
Like I'd like to take him behind the gym if I were in high school.
If we were in high school, I'd take him behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
When was the last time an actor assassinated a president?
They're still going to have to go out and put a bullet in Donald Trump.
Show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and peaceful.
I have thought an awful lot about blowing up the White House.
If you had to be stuck in an elevator with either President Trump, Mike Pence, or Jeff Sessions, who would it be?
Does one of us have to come out alive?
So in there you had Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren. Johnny Depp is the one that said that thing about when's the last time an actor assassinated a president? I mean, that is seriously troubling language. Kamala Harris was the person speaking to Ellen DeGeneres at the end, who said, does someone have to come out alive? So these are key people within the Democrat Party, active politicians and actors and so on. But listen, it's ultimately up to you to decide on. Both sides took liberties, creative liberties, let's say, with the editing and the splicing of their videos and the kind of decisions that they made to leave out certain bits of context. So the Trump side, the defense side, were sort of saying, hang on, that same rally that you're accusing Trump of inciting insurrection at, he also said other things which, with context, make it all seem a lot better. So, for instance, one of the quotes was that he said at that rally on the 6th of January, everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard. So that's a quote from the Save America rally on the 6th of January, and they're saying, look, if you take the fighting talk bit, but you ignore that bit, then of course it looks like Trump is inciting insurrection. But you need to include everything so that it's clear that when he talks fighting talk, it's only metaphors. But then again, I mean, look at me trying to be really balanced. Then again, the Democrat side was saying, well, the clips that you took of our team did not result in an angry mob breaking into the Capitol building, breaking into the crux of our democracy. So our team's words were metaphors, but Trump's words resulted in illegal results. So this was the kind of back and forth between the two sides, and kind of unhelpfully for the Trump defense, you've now got rioters, actual rioters from the day on the 6th of January, who have now been arrested by the FBI because they stupidly put videos of themselves on social media. So they begged to be arrested, essentially. But these rioters are coming forward and they're saying, well, I was only doing what the president told me to do. So I don't think I broke the law because I was literally following my leader's instructions, who is the boss of the government. So I was doing what he told me to do. In fact, here's a really interesting clip. Have a listen to this. It's Jenna Ryan, who is a Texan real estate agent. She chartered a private jet to Washington for that rally. And then she was one of these people who posted a load of pictures and videos of herself on social media at that riot. She got into the building. She's at one point posing by one of the broken windows. But she is one of these people that's come out and said, I did what my president told me to do.
I would say
I felt like I was doing my patriotic duty. So me personally, I do not feel a sense of shame or guilt from my heart from what I was doing. I thought I was following my president. I thought I was following what we were called to do, flying there. He asked us to fly there. He asked us to be there. So I was doing what he asked us to do. So as far as in my heart of hearts, do I feel like a criminal? No. Do I feel guilty? No. But I do feel a little wronged in the situation, because I'm like, okay, I'm a real estate agent, and this has taken my company. It's taken my business. I'm getting slandered all over the internet, all over the world, and all the news. And I'm just like a normal person. And one day I woke up and I, of course it was the election. It was intense. It was an intense election for everyone. And I just happened to be at the Capitol when the president said to go there. It was just and I happened to be a social media person. So
that's Jenna Ryan there, one of the rioters. And the quote is, I thought I was following my president. I thought I was following what we were called to do. So that line played perfectly into the hands of the Democrats, which is ironic because she's such an avid Trump supporter that she fucking chartered a jet to go to the riot to support him. But now, you know, everything she's saying couldn't be more music to the ears of the Democrats. Although, again, Trump's team would look at what she's saying and say, but it was ultimately her choice to take what he was saying literally. She did that of her own volition. Trump didn't tell her to do that. So look, it's up to you to decide how you feel about that debate. And like I said before, that's, in my opinion, the one that's worth having. This thing about Trump not being president anymore, so we shouldn't look to convict him, I'm not sure that's fair, because if that's how it works, then that means any president has a carte blanche to do whatever they want in the final part of their presidency, because by the time Congress gets around to impeaching them, they'll be out of office. So they can do whatever they want. That is not a good precedent to be setting. One thing I haven't mentioned yet, and it's so important that I do, because it's probably my favourite aspect to this trial, is this initial speech. If you saw it, then you know what I'm going to talk about. Is this initial speech from Trump's defence team. So this is essentially the first impression you get of their whole strategy for this trial. So it's kind of a big deal. It sets the tone, and it's very important for the senators to work out, right, are these guys doing a good job? Are they the real deal? So the lawyer, sorry, I'm laughing because it's so funny because I'm thinking about it already. The lawyer, his name's Bruce Castor, he stands up and he talks for about, well, he didn't talk, he rambled for about 48 minutes or something absolutely ridiculous. I tried to watch it all, I tell you, I tried, but I cannot explain to you how weird it was. Do you ever have that where someone's talking to you and you think, I know that you're speaking English, but I've no idea what you're saying? Like when someone's sleep talking and you think, right, these are English words, but you're not making sentences. That was this. In fact, this is a better analogy. Bear with me. Do you know when you were at school and, Mum, if you're listening, I'm really sorry. You know when you were at school and you had a French essay that was due and you hadn't done any work on it and you thought, do you know what I'm going to do? I'll write it in English, but I'll put it into Google Translate. I won't look at the result. I'll just hand it in and hope for the best. That's what that speech was. Bruce Castor's speech was like something that had been put into Google Translate and not checked over. I'm going to play you some. It's the only way that you'll understand what I'm talking about, but promise me that you're not going to switch off, because I'm telling you, you won't be able to understand what he's talking about. Have a listen.
Something that... that Mr. Raskin and his team brought up is that it's somehow a suggestion from former President Trump's team that when various public officials were not denouncing the violence that we saw over the summer, that was somehow the former president equating that speech to his own. Not at all. Exactly backwards. This trial is not about trading liberty for security. It's about suggesting that it is a good idea that we give up those liberties that we have so long fought for.
Do you know what I mean now? I tried to listen to it all the way through, could not. And I definitely lost brain cells listening to it again now. And my favourite bit, I need to play my favourite bit from that speech. It was right at the start, I think, when he said this.
I'll be quite frank with you. We changed what we were going to do on account that we thought that the House manager's presentation was well done.
So if you need proof that that was a last minute back of a fag packet job, then there you have it. Is the guy getting up on stage and saying, we actually changed our entire strategy when we heard the other guy's speech. Like, it's just outrageous. And unsurprisingly, we did not hear from Bruce Castor much after that. And apparently Trump was completely incandescent, like watching it on his TV in Florida and shouting and screaming because of how disastrous it was. Not good. And by most accounts, that Bruce Castor opening had a direct impact. Obviously not a massive one, because I've told you the results already. You know them. Trump walked away. He got acquitted. But Bruce Castor's speech did have an impact because Bill Cassidy, who was the senator for Louisiana, until that point, he'd voted to protect Trump, right? Everything he'd done until that point was on Trump's side. But after Castor stood on stage and rambled for 48 minutes, Cassidy changed his mind. Have a listen to this.
I said I'd be an impartial juror. Anyone listening to those arguments, the House managers were focused, they were organized, they relied upon both precedent, the Constitution, and legal scholars. They made a compelling argument. President Trump's team were disorganized. They did everything they could but to talk about the question at hand. And when they talked about it, they kind of glided over it, almost as if they were embarrassed of their arguments. Now, if I'm an impartial juror, and one side's doing a great job, and the other side's doing a terrible job on the issue at hand, as an impartial juror, I'm going to vote for the side that did the good job.
Why did you think the Trump defense team did a terrible job?
Did you listen to it?
I did.
Okay, then you it speaks for itself.
So that was Republican Bill Cassidy, who ended up being one of the seven Republicans to break ranks and to vote to convict Trump. And from that clip, I mean, I'm just imagining Bruce Castor, who will have definitely seen that clip, and he'll be thinking, oh, I just wish I hadn't even bothered. I shouldn't have bothered speaking at all. And maybe, you know, Bill Cassidy would have voted to acquit Trump. You know, I'm probably the direct reason why Trump got seven votes to convict from the Republican side rather than six. And that bit where the journalist was like, what was your issue with the defense? And Cassidy just turns around and says, did you listen to it? Did you listen to it? Absolutely outrageous. Okay, so we know about some of the key moments from the trial. We've got you squared away with the basic arguments, you know, the arguments for and the arguments against convicting Trump. So I thought it would be nice to get some analysis from the ultimate guru, Trevor McCriskin, Associate Professor of US Politics at the University of Warwick. My, what do you call it? My alma mater? Or is that an American thing? I don't know. My university. And he is my own personal hero. So he jumped on a call with me yesterday and offered some absolutely amazing insight.
Hello.
Hello. You okay?
I'm in your cupboard again.
I know. Cupboard's POV. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. How about you?
Yeah, I'm all right. I'm kind of sick of looking at this cupboard. But listen, I want to get your reactions. Did you at any point through this think that Trump would be convicted?
I think back on January 6th, I did wonder, because on the day of the riot itself, when they came back into session, the speeches that were being given by the senators at that point, apart from one or two sort of very strong pro-Trumpers like Josh Hawley, you really got the sense that maybe something had changed that day, and that, you know, they felt so personally attacked by what had happened that they weren't going to stand by the president anymore. But as soon as things started to move forward from there, it then became fairly obvious that actually there weren't enough Republicans that had the sort of, I don't know if it's strength of character or the guts to break with Trump.
Do you think that's why? Because we saw 7 Republicans broke ranks. That's kind of about what I was expecting. I knew it'd be more than last time. Last time, only 1 broke ranks in Donald Trump's initial impeachment. Mitt Romney was the only one. This time, 7, including Mitt Romney, who did it again. He just hates Trump. We know that. Why do you think so many Republicans remained loyal, even though he's not president anymore and he isn't even in public office anymore? Why? What were they loyal to?
People talk about Trump's base, and it's the people that are really, you know, completely think he's the best thing that's ever happened to American politics because he's this outside force coming in, shaking it all up and everything else. I think that most of the senators who are Republicans, most of that 50 that sit within the Senate at the moment, looked at their constituencies and thought, actually, on balance, the number of Republican voters in my constituency that supported Donald Trump throughout his presidency, I can't afford to break with that and vote against that and, you know, convict President Trump. Again, it's all politics, isn't it? I mean, this whole process is incredibly political.
I know. That's why it just feels all very silly. Because in a trial that's not this, in a like a regular crime trial, you have a judge and a jury and witnesses, and they're all separate people who all play a role. But in an impeachment of a president, the Senate are the judge and the jury. But in this case, they're the witnesses because they were the ones who were in the building when it was stormed. And the very room that they had the trial was the crime scene because that's what people broke into. So the fact that this was trying to be in any way free, fair and impartial is absolutely absurd. It's obviously purely political. And that's why, you know, as a commentator, people were asking me, are you glued to the TV? Are you watching it thoroughly? And I kind of thought, no, not really, because I know exactly what's going to happen. Because
yeah.
It's completely dominated by everyone's individual political agenda. It's not being run by lawyers and judges who have an impartial view to just upholding the Constitution and not worrying about, you know, being elected or pissing Trump off or pissing their electorate off. So it all felt very
No, that's exactly
silly.
Right. I mean, it is a political process, and it's the whole thing is highly politicized. It has been every time there's been an impeachment.
You say that, but actually loads of comparisons are being drawn between this and the Watergate scandal. Obviously, most people know, but just for anyone who doesn't, that was what got Richard Nixon impeached in the 1970s when evidence came out that he had overseen a break-in of the Democrat headquarters. He was, of course, a Republican. The Democrat headquarters, aka the Watergate building. And you say that impeachments are always political and people are serving their own political agenda. But in that event, in the Watergate scandal, Nixon's own party, the Republican Party, told him to stand down. And in the Watergate break-in, nobody died. So on the scale of kind of controversy and tragedy, it was lower down, surely. But the Republican Party still didn't protect Nixon. You know, they didn't help him or support him. They said, you've cocked up so badly, you need to go. So he actually did. He stepped down before the Senate trial even happened. Surely that's much more logical and less political than this. Why is there such a difference between what the Republican Party did then compared to their behaviour towards Trump this time around?
The difference is that at the point that Nixon resigned, his vice president stepped up and became president, Gerald Ford, and there was 2 more years before the next presidential election.
So it was timing.
In that situation, yeah, a lot of this is to do with timing, right? I mean, we wouldn't have had the events of the last few weeks had there not been a presidential election in November, which Trump refused to accept the outcome of. But the very fact that he'd lost that election and the, you know, the Republicans not only had lost the presidency, but they also lost the Senate. So they will fight for every little bit of, I shouldn't use that word fight, should I? That's what got Trump into trouble. They will do everything they can within their power to resist the Democratic agenda at every turn, unless there's something so uncontroversial that everybody agrees with it. This was not something that was uncontroversial. But the fact that seven Republicans did come across and vote with the Democrats, that is not insignificant.
Although if you look at those seven, they mostly broke ranks from a position of safety or relative safety. So Richard Burr, Senator for North Carolina, he's said that he's retiring. So did Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Those two voted to convict Trump, but they're not running again. So they're not worried about losing the Trump base and, you know, sacrificing future elections. They can feel a bit more free to actually follow their conscience in this.
Yeah.
Bill Cassidy, Senator for Louisiana, I've talked about him before, he only just got reelected literally the other month. So he has his seat for 6 years. He has time to win the loyal Trump supporters in his state back around. Same goes for Ben Sasse of Nebraska and Susan Collins of Maine. Same situation. They just got their seats, 6 more years. A lot can happen in that time. But it is interesting to see how basically most of the Republican senators, most of those seven who did break rank, didn't have a huge amount at stake in their own political career. So they had the freedom to actually vote how they wanted to vote. So you can't help but wonder, if more Republicans were in a safer situation, would they have voted to convict too?
Yeah. And, you know, and this isn't the end of the story. Just because the president hasn't been convicted by an impeachment trial doesn't mean that he's completely out of the woods. You know, there are other aspects of what's been happening in the last few months that are under investigation. You know, there's possible legal proceedings that might be brought against him in Georgia around the pressure that he tried to put on officials in that state to reverse the outcome of the election in Georgia. And we've also heard today that there's going to be an independent commission that will investigate what happened on the 6th of January. And that, again, you know, it will probably play out in public, have hearings in public, and there will be a report at the end of it that may well be even more damning of President Trump's involvement here than, you know, the House impeachment managers put forward.
But there's a bit of confusion about this because he wasn't convicted. I think a lot of people, especially in the UK, think, right, well, does that kind of make him a bit immune from being convicted on a legal basis for anything because he used to be president? So does he not have this sort of bubble of protection?
No.
So he could go to jail.
Impeachment is to determine whether an individual within government has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, or in other ways, you know, not faithfully executed their role. And there wasn't enough to convict on that, but that has no bearing at all. This political process has no bearing at all on any legal processes that might be brought beyond this particular process.
Right. Because I think there's a feeling of the 6th of January happened, the Democrats tried to impeach and convict Trump. We've now discovered that that was unsuccessful. He's off the hook forever. But that's not the case at all. The 6th of January will still very well potentially have consequences that will directly affect Donald Trump. He may even go to jail for things he's done. And not even the 6th of January, you know, trying to, like you were saying, convince officials in Georgia to find 11,000 votes. That wasn't okay either.
Find me more votes. Find me more votes. Yeah.
Okay. So he's not off the hook.
He's not. And there are lots of, you know, other sort of question marks over some of his financial dealings that may be looked into I think there's a court in New York that's looking at his tax records. There's all sorts of things that are sort of buzzing around former President Trump that yet get him into legal trouble.
Right. Just lastly, if Trump gets, you know, he's been acquitted from this impeachment trial, but then in the future, like you say, there's committees being put together to put together an inquiry about what happened on January 6th. He may get done in for his taxes. He may get done in for trying to acquire votes in Georgia. If he manages to somehow swerve all of that, do you think he'll run again in 2024?
I do think he'll run again if he can get through all of the mess that he has sort of created for himself. But I think one of the big questions is whether he would be successful in securing the Republican nomination for the presidency. So he can stand as much as he wants, right? He can put himself forward, but he would need to be selected through the primary processes And that's where, yes, of course, his base will come out strongly in support of him. But if the party hasn't thrown their weight behind him, they throw it behind an alternative candidate. It may well be that one of these senators that stood by him through this process decides to run for president and goes to Trump and says, I want your blessing. I want you to step out of the race and let me run and take your base with me. You know, that could happen as well. But then beyond all of that, and this is probably the Republicans' biggest fear, is that Trump gets so, either he fails to secure that nomination, or it's obvious that he's not going to be the kind of candidate that the Republican Party will throw themselves behind. It's even being suggested that he could run as an independent candidate or even form his own party. If he does that, that could really cause problems for the Republican Party, because they may find themselves unable to win a presidential election in 4 years' time because their vote is split between their own party and whatever it is that Trump puts together.
And these, I don't envy the kind of tightrope that these people are walking of trying to please Trump's base, but also trying to make sure that kind of these old school traditional Republicans don't break away from them either. So they've got a hell of a task to hedge their bets and try and be popular amongst parties that kind of hate each other at this point. I don't envy the task they've got.
Yeah, no, not at all. And it could be that the Republican Party really tears itself apart in the next few years over these kinds of questions and these struggles. But then, of course, it's what happens on the other side? What do the Democrats do? How far can Joe Biden's presidency prove to be a success and really kind of shore up his support and make it more likely that he's going to get re-elected in 4 years' time?
I don't think he's going to run. They've got to pick the right person to keep that momentum. Yeah, so both sides have got work to do.
Which, as ever, makes American politics absolutely fascinating.
I know. I love it. Well, thank you again.
You take care of yourself.
I will. You too.
See you again soon.
That was Trevor McCriskin there, my favourite university lecturer. His seminars were the best because, I mean, you can imagine it was just a bunch of people who all loved politics sitting around and debating American politics, and he's there chairing it, and he's just lovely, and it was just a lovely time. It was a wholesome time. I'll leave his Twitter handle below if you want to check him out, and he's constantly on the telly and on radio kind of explaining to the journalists what's going on. He's that guy. And to be honest, this is a chunky episode, so I'm going to leave it there. I really think that is more than enough of a foundation for you to understand any unfolding news about the sort of fallout from the trial. Thank you so much for listening. If you found that helpful, and you definitely did find it helpful, please become a patron. I just can't carry these on without the wonderful folks who do chip in and who are part of the community. So I really implore you to do the same if you want to keep this going. You essentially buy me a coffee and you gain access to a bunch of bonus content, interviews, vlogs, opinion pieces, and you can live happily in the knowledge that you're the reason why I can keep doing this. So the link to that is in the episode description. I'll save the recommendation of the week till the next episode because this is a long one and it's 2:25 in the morning, so I'm going to go to bed. Follow me on social media before you go, @JuliaBell_X. Send me a message, leave a lovely review. That really makes me feel good. And that's it, you lovely lot. Thank you for being brilliant and I will see you in the next one. Okay, goodbye.